Right, so we enter the last phase of the drama and of our day. And I'll just tell you what the intention is. I hope we don't run out of time. But I'm just going to say a little bit about Act 4, Scene 1, which takes us a little further in. I talked in relation to the dramatic plot structure of the turning point and then the falling action, if you remember. And at this point, the nobles have really begun to turn, begun to feel repentance for their sins. The marriage it hasn't actually happened, but the romance between Ferdinand and Miranda has been, as it were, blessed by a kind of magic mask, which just takes place just before this passage I'm about to read, which is a kind of celebration of the divinity of that marriage. And as I said, and which can be seen very much as a confirmation of Ferdinand's own inner evolution of it coming to a culmination in this marriage within his own soul. So he's passed the test that Prospero set him. But then suddenly, this mask, this beautiful mask, nymphs and graceful dances and all the rest of it, suddenly Prospero turns aside and his mood darkens. So this moment of joy is suddenly ruined. He says, "I had forgot that foul conspiracy of the beast Caliban and his confederates against my life. They were planning to murder him. The minute of their plot is almost come." And the spirits just depart. It's another illusory show that just disappears into thin air. And Ferdinand says to Miranda, "This is strange. Your father's in some passion that works him strongly. He's agitated. Miranda never till this day saw him touched with anger so distempered." Interesting word, distempered. So he's suddenly been embraced, as it were, by this anger at the thought of these people who want to murder him. And you've got to remember, we're talking in this play about he starts off with the motive of revenge against Antonio, who's taken his throne, and the others who helped him, Alonso and so on. And, of course, Prospero is going through his own evolution as a man, admittedly a man of the very highest order, but he is going through an evolution also, and he's reached a kind of pinch point at this moment. And Miranda says, "Never till this day saw I him touched with anger so distempered." And then Prospero turns to Ferdinand, his future son-in-law, and he says, "You do look, my son, in a moved sort, as if you were dismayed. Be cheerful, sir. Be cheerful, sir." So Ferdinand looks worried about him looking worried, and he says to Ferdinand, don't worry. Rather like he said to Miranda at the beginning, no harm done when she was upset about the apparent storm and the loss of life on the ship. And then this wonderful speech spoken to Ferdinand, but with much more universal reverberations. "Our revels now are ended. These, our actors, as I foretold you, are all melted into air, into thin air. And, like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep." So we've been talking a lot today about people's perceptions, worlds of worlds that aren't there. Ferdinand reacts to apparent state of Prospero, and he says, don't worry. And then he explains to him, as it were, the nature of nature. Let's just, I wonder if we could have some volunteers. What I'd like to do is have a whole lot of you up here, and I'd like each person to read a line. Can we have, let's say, six of you. Would six of you come up? Don't all rush at the same time. That's one. We need five more. That's two. Three, four, thank you. Excellent. You'll just take it in turns. I don't know your name.
Stefan.
All right, and we're just going to take it in turns, starting from Stefan, then going down to the end of the line and then coming back to Stefan. And we're just going to read and try and hear. I mean, it'd be quite nice if we could just, I don't know, you don't have to, but close your eyes or whatever helps you to refine the attention. And also, equally, those who are speaking the lines, if you could really listen to the sound of your own voice and just let it happen. Relax. Just let it happen. Enjoy these beautiful words, starting with, "Our revels now are ended." So let's just try that. So, Stefan?
"Our revels now are ended. These are actors..."
"As I foretold you, we're all spirits, and..."
"Are melted into air, into thin air."
"And, like the baseless fabric of this vision..."
"The cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces..."
"The solemn temples, the great globe itself..."
"Yea, all which it inherit shall dissolve."
"And, like this insubstantial pageant, faded..."
"Leave not a wreck behind. We are such stuff..."
"As dreams are made on, and our little life..."
"Is rounded with a sleep. Sir, I am vexed."
Okay, I think we'll just leave it there. Can we have a round of applause, please? There we are. It wasn't so bad, was it? Well, this speech is one of those very famous speeches that many of you will have heard before. In the light of our day so far, and going back to what Robin was saying before about the globe being now, that all this lovely poetry and so on is about you and me now, as we sit here or stand here and look out into this universe. Anything, I mean, if you like, reflect on that speech again for a few minutes or a minute. But is there anything that arises on hearing those words? Not on just intellectual thinkings about it, but just anything that arises from hearing that speech.
Yes, the way it ends
beautifully, rounds it off. But it also suggests a circle. Can you talk about that?
Well, interestingly, he draws a circle, Prospero, and he gets the nobles to step into it, this magic. We talk about the magic circle, don't we? Life works in cycles, doesn't it? It's circular in motion. The planets are elliptical in their orbits and so on. And that is the nature of life, of the natural laws, it seems, of creation. They start at one point and they come back, you know, rather as we were speaking at the beginning, about the beginning and the end being the same thing, ultimately. So what this speech is talking about, surely, is the nature of the nature that we are currently experiencing right now, with its apparent substantiality. And it appears, does it not, that we are born and that we die, that in that cycle, in that circle, whether it's a galaxy or an individual human being, there is a circle of life and death, and that seems to be it, really. It doesn't matter on what scale you take it, that seems to be it. But what this perhaps is pointing to is that drama, whether it be on the scale of galaxies or on the scale of my big toe, is all illusory. Those incredible natural laws that operate, that create this great drama of rising and falling, this actually points to another theme within Shakespeare and within this play of chaos and order. Throughout Shakespeare, you find the themes of chaos and order. So, for instance, Prospero was the Duke of Milan. He got rather too interested in natural magic and so on, neglected his duties. Chaos ensued, presumably, because when the leader doesn't do his job, chaos ensues, and eventually he's usurped by his brother, and then he loses his position, and the cycle of his life then turns to, you know, the island and everything that then follows, and then the possibility of revenge, because he's gained these powers, and he's given the possibility of doing that, and so on. So there are these great cycles in life. But the question is, I would say, how do you get out of the circle? How do you break out of a circle? If this is the nature of life, back and forth, back and forth. Some people believe in rebirth, don't they? That the transmigration of the souls and all the rest of it. It's a constant repetition. So the question is, and in the light of the central subject, I would say, of this play, which is freedom, how can you break free from that? How do you break free from those apparently iron laws of nature, both within and without? And I think the answer, possibly, is in this play. But we haven't come to the end of it yet. Does that help? It does involve something, by the way, called grace.
The line, we are such stuff as dreams are made on. I first thought it was, we are such stuff as dreams are made of. And yet it's very different to be made of dreams than to have dreams made on us. To be made of dreams implies that we are insubstantial. We are part of that sort of unreal.
Yeah.
And but all these dreams are made on us implies that we are the sort of substratum. We are the sort of the basis on which all this happens. There's a much, and that one little word, I think I've had that line in my head always, as we are such dreams, such things as dreams are made on.
You've no idea how many times I've been told off because I say, exactly as you said, we are such stuff as dreams are made on. He said, no, it's of. And I said, no, just have a look at the text. It's not an F, it's an N. And as you say, it does make a world of difference. But what does it really mean, I wonder? Any offers? We are such stuff as dreams are made on. What does that mean?
We have the potential to think as freely as that, to be as open-minded as to be able to forge dreams.
Right. So what are we?
Dreams.
Is that what it's saying? It's saying that we are such stuff as dreams are made on.
Made of the same stuff as dreams are.
Is that what he's actually saying?
We're real.
It's on.
We're real.
On. So it would seem to be implying that there's, as it were, a substratum, yeah? That's what we are, and that all these dreams, this dream world, takes place within that. At night, when we go to sleep, who knows what happens in our dreams? We're chased by tigers and all the rest of it. And then we wake up and we say, it took place in me. Is that right? We know that we're not the guy who has been chased by the tiger because we've woken up. Yeah? So the line implies, interestingly, that we're not of the stuff of the dreams. We're not of that changing current, be it cyclical or whatever, with that on which it all, or in which it all, takes place. That's what we are, says Prospero, and perhaps Shakespeare says through Prospero to us.
Isn't it what you've got behind you?
What have I got behind me?
Screen.
A blank.
A screen.
What is a screen?
You're making dreams of.
Yes. There would seem to be a screen. But as you know, you get the guy who sees a lady being chased by a villain in a film and then actually gets up from his seat and then actually assaults the screen thinking that it's for real. And that's not too clever. You should enjoy the drama, shouldn't you? So anyhow, I don't want to press this too much. It's a wonderful speech. I would recommend reflecting on it, reading it again and again. It's a rich resource. There are no final answers to these things. But the point about the on and the of is rather crucial, because it's seeing what's actually there, not what appears to be there. of could be what appears to be there and might confirm some ideas we might have about ourselves. But it's not of, it's on. Huge world of difference. Okay, we're trying to move on and, as it were, we'll get to the epilogue in a second. But just before that is a wonderful scene, and do we have Shelley? And I guess going to enact it very quickly, it's only very brief, and Dave also. And this is, if you're looking at your text, it's 5:1, the beginning of Act 5, Scene 1, okay, which begins, Prosperous says, "Now does my project gather to a head." Okay, and we're going to go through to the end, where there's some solemn music, there's so much music, light, to 57, "I'll drown my book," if you're looking at your text, and we'll see what arises from that. So enter Prospero, and he's in his magic robes, along with Ariel so often. "Now does my project gather to a head. My charms crack not, my spirits obey, and time goes upright with his carriage." How's the day?
"On the sixth hour, at which time, my lord, you said our work should cease?"
"I did say so when first I raised the tempest. Say, my spirit, how fares the king and his followers?"
"Confined together in the same fashion as you gave in charge, just as you left them, all prisoners, sir, in the lime grove, which weather fends your cell. They cannot budge till your release. The king, his brother, and yours abide all three distracted, and the remainder mourning over them, brimful of sorrow and dismay. But chiefly, him you termed, sir, the good old Lord Gonzalo, his tears run down his beard like winter's drops from eaves of reeds. Your charms so strongly work them that if you now beheld them, your affections would become tender."
"Dost thou think so, spirit?"
"Mine would, sir, were I human."
"And mine shall. Hast thou, which art but e'er a touch, a feeling of their afflictions, and shall not myself, one of their kind, that relish all as sharply passion as they, be kindlier moved than thou art? Though with these high wrongs I am struck to the quick, yet with my nobler reason against my fury do I take part. The rarer action is in virtue than in vengeance. They, being penitent, the sole drift of my purpose doth extend not a frown further. Go, release them. Ariel, my charms, I'll break their senses, I'll restore, and they shall be themselves."
"I'll fetch them, sir."
Traces a circle. "Ye elves of hills, brooks, standing lakes and groves,
and ye that on the sands with printless foot
do chase the ebbing Neptune and do fly him
when he comes back, you demi-puppets that
by moonshine do the green sour ringlets make,
whereof the ewe not bites, and you whose pastime
is to make midnight mushrooms that rejoice
to hear the solemn curfew, by whose aid
weak masters though ye be, I have bedimmed
the noontide sun, call forth the mutinous winds,
and twixt the green sea and the azured vault
set roaring war, to the dread rattling thunder
have I given fire and rifted Jove's stout oak
with his own bolt, the strong-based promontory
have I made shake, and by the spurs plucked up
the pine and cedar, graves at my command
have waked their sleepers, oped and let them forth
by my so potent art. But this rough magic
I here abjure, and when I have required
some heavenly music, which even now I do,
to work mine end upon their senses that
this airy charm is for, I'll break my staff,
bury it certain fathoms in the earth,
and deeper than did ever plummet sound,
I'll drown my book." So, this is obviously a crucial point in the play and for Prospero, because he has decided, he's moved by Ariel's being moved, by the state of the court party, who are in a terrible state. They are full of penitence, as he says, for their crimes, in tears and so on and so forth. And so he shows this quality of compassion. First of all, Ariel shows it, and as it were, Prospero picks up this compassion from him and suddenly says that, as he says here, though with their high wrongs I am struck to the quick, yet with my nobler reason, against my fury, do I take part. That's a decision. He could have gone with his passion, but he goes with his reason. And he says, the rarer action is in virtue than in vengeance. They, being penitent, the sole drift of my purpose, doth extend not a frown further. And then suddenly, go release them, Ariel. Again, release, liberation. My charms I'll break, their senses I'll restore, and they shall be themselves. So they've gone through their journey, a fiery journey, and he's now finally releasing them from the tests that they've had to undergo, the pain, the suffering. And vengeance is, he says, no longer his motive. He's let go within himself of all that is implied in that. But then he goes a step further in this wonderful, wonderful speech, this beautiful, beautiful poetry, this powerful, powerful poetry. And then ending where he says, but this rough magic, rough in the sense of the lower magic, you know, we talked about the greater mysteries and the lower mysteries, and the lower mysteries, or the you know, lower aspects of his art, relate to what you might call white magic, black magic, whatever you like. So he's renouncing all that knowledge, everything, all the powers that it gives him over nature and over others. But this rough magic I here abjure, renounce. And when I have required some heavenly music, which even now I do, to work mine end upon their senses that this airy charm is for, I'll break my staff, his staff being the as it were, the vehicle of his power, bury it certain fathoms in the earth, and deeper than did ever plummet sound, I'll drown my book. Isn't that a lovely phrase? I'll drown my book. But what he's really drowning is all that knowledge, all that, everything that he'd taken to himself, all that power. Imagine having the power to create thunderstorms, to make people do what you want, to make beautiful women appear or banquets appear, whatever, to do, be able to do anything. And imagine being able to give all that up, lock, stock and barrel, completely. I mean, why? Anything, again, arising from that scene, anything that anyone would like to say in relation to all that? Yeah. Sorry, do we have a mic or are we not? Yeah. Well, it was. I said that it's a workshop and it's spontaneous. I hadn't decided at the beginning of the day to do it, but it just suddenly came to me that it would be a good way. You know, when you change things around, people suddenly start listening. So it's good to get an audience slightly off balance, to do something unexpected, and then there's a greater chance that perhaps they can hear. That's the kind of idea. It may work, it may not work. But it's a wonderful, I think, you know, the other thing one shouldn't forget in all this is just simply the sheer beauty of the poetry. The power and the beauty of some of those lines, I think, are just amazing. Just amazing. They're powerful lines, and yet they're lines about the giving up of power.
I think it's interesting that the sympathy comes first from Ariel. I think it's interesting that the sympathy comes first from Ariel.
Yeah, yeah.
And she prompts, I put a she in.
He or she or it, yes.
And she prompts.
That's right. That's right. It is interesting. And they have a very interesting relationship together. They have a little bit of argy-bargy at the beginning when Ariel is described as moody. He wants his release and he wants it now, thank you very much. And Prospero says, no, not quite yet. You've got a part to play. And remember that I liberated you from the cloven pine, which Sycorax, the witch, put you in. There's still a role for you to play out, and you've got to do it. And eventually he does agree. And this, we mentioned in our study group, the idea of service. And Ferdinand learns about service. We've got to remember that Ferdinand is perhaps one of the most powerful people in Europe. He's the son of the King of Naples. Naples is one of the most powerful forces in Europe. And he's being made to chop wood. He's been brought down to his knees. He's a nothing. And he has to go through that to earn the honor of marrying Miranda, or some people would put it himself, of getting to a point where he is ready for that inner marriage within himself. He has to learn humility, if you like. He has to get down on his knees. And that's what Prospero perhaps is teaching him. Perhaps there's something we could learn about that. So what is he doing? He's surrendering.
Yeah, he's surrendering.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. He's giving up all that power.
Yeah.
Totally. He's just, as it were, throwing it away.
Yeah.
And that's a stage in his evolution, because through the act of no longer working from the sound of revenge, I would suggest he's come to a new place within himself. And this is the beginning of the end of the story, which ends with the epilogue, which we're going to look at in a minute. But it is part of his own journey, because before that he's disturbed. Remember, when he thinks of Caliban and all the rest of it, he is just disturbed. And then suddenly, we had this piece about our revels now are ended and all the rest of it, where he's talking about the real nature of things, that it is really illusory, however it may appear, and so on. But as far as this is concerned, he has now come to a new point of realization, perhaps within himself. He no longer needs all this stuff. But he's open. He's making himself vulnerable, because when you do that, well, then what? So, we haven't got a lot of time to go in. I mean, it'd be lovely to go into this speech in more detail. But, what he's surrendering to, I would suggest, is reason, not passion. And funny enough, later on, there's this wonderful line where he says, this is Prospero speaking, and he says, in relation to the evolution of these nobles and what they're going through in terms of their development, talking about them, he says, their understanding begins to swell, and the approaching tide will shortly fill the reasonable shore that now lies foul and muddy. So their understanding begins to swell, and the approaching tide will shortly fill the reasonable shore that now lies foul and muddy. So in relation to the nobles and their, as it were, level of being, they have also come to a new understanding, and is also related to reason. Now, so we come towards the end, and all the bits and pieces that have gone out left, right, and center are going to come back into the center and reach some completion. But also the mood of the play suddenly changes, because with him giving up the powers, you think, you might get depressed at that, you've given up everything. But actually, suddenly, the whole mood in the play lightens, and back comes Ariel with a song. And he's busily putting on a garment Prospero. And while he's putting it on, like a good Batman or whatever, he sings. He's singing because of his joy in relation to his imminent freedom, because he wants his freedom too. And he now knows that he's at the point where he is also going to be released. He or she, it, whatever, is going to be released. So let's hear this wonderful song from the beautiful voice of Helen, which, as I say, marks a bit of sunshine suddenly appearing.
watch when owls do cry, when owls do cry, when owls do cry. On a bat's back I do fly, I do fly. After summer, merrily, merrily, after summer, merrily. Merrily, merrily shall I live now, under the blossom that hangs on the bough, under the blossom that hangs on the bough.
It's spring again. Spring again. The epilogue. It's relatively unusual for Shakespeare to come up with epilogue. He does it sometimes. But as I said, this has a particular resonance because it's his last play, certainly his last play written just by him. And it's worth just hearing it. And this is what he says. Now my charms are all o'erthrown, and what strength I have's mine own, which is most faint. Now, 'tis true, I must be here confined by you, or sent to Naples. Let me not, since I have my dukedom got, and pardon the deceiver, dwell in this bare island by your spell. But release me from my bands, with the help of your good hands. Gentle breath of yours my sails must fill, or else my project fails, which was to please. Now I want spirits to enforce, art to enchant, and my ending is despair unless I be relieved by prayer which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself and frees all faults. As you from crimes would pardoned be, let your indulgence set me free. I don't want to say very much about it. I don't know if anyone wants to say anything in relation to that. But the sense I get from it, for what it's worth, is here you have a man of the very highest order, perhaps one of the greatest men, I would say, that have ever lived. And he's had this career for, you know, 20, 25 years, whatever it is. And he knows in himself he's come to the end, he's coming to the end of it all. The magic show is over. And, you know, well, what next, you might say. It's just like someone who's had a glorious sporting career or whatever, and suddenly it stops. And then what? And what he seems to do, it seems to me, is that he has been serving, we were talking about service, he's been serving his audience, he's been serving his time, the people of his time, and it's as if he's turning to those people, to his audience, and saying, please, I've done my bit, as it were, I've performed my role in the play, and now it's time for me to be released from that, to go free. But I can't go free without your help. I need you to release me. And when he says my ending is despair, unless it be, my ending is despair, unless it be relieved by prayer, which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself. So his ending is despair, unless it be relieved by prayer, which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself. An interesting phrase, and one might ask, well, what is a prayer that can assault mercy itself? What is the quality, what is the nature of that prayer, which he's saying will bring him release, and perhaps he's saying could bring any of us release or freedom. And rather than putting any completion on that. I'd like to leave that open to you all today as a question. What is that prayer? What is the nature of that prayer within our own hearts that has the power to assault mercy? And mercy, one could say, is love with a capital L, the very substance and perhaps source of the creation, we are told. What is it? What is the nature of that prayer within ourselves, within our own hearts, that will bring that freedom and release? We know the physical body will be released in time, and all the elements will go back into their universal elements within nature. But if it's true that we are such stuff as dreams are made on, that we're not stuff which comes and goes and in these long cycles, but that we truly are that on which or in which it's all happening, what is the prayer, the quality of the prayer, that will bring us to the realization that we are not governed by change, but are in fact that in which change takes place? What is the nature of that? And I would say to you, as you leave today, look to your heart. Thank you.
Philip, thank you very much indeed. When you first came and said that 11 till 4 wasn't really long enough, I thought, oh, you know, don't be greedy. But you have given us such richness today, and yet you've also shown us that we've only scratched the surface. We're very grateful for that. I came to this thinking of the famous line, you know, all the world's a stage. And it made me begin to think, then, if all the world's the stage, if everything we do is in the script, and we are merely actors, nothing mere about actors, but then where is the audience? And of course, I think, Lucy, you picked it up in a question in our small group, that the audience is the Atman, and so it's complete and unseparated. And the performance and the enjoyment are one. And I think you've helped show us that. And we're very grateful to you and your wonderful band of travelling players. Thank you very much.
Thank you.